Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Greg Baer, the co-author of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids. This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging, relevant, and equitable learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change. On today's episode, I'm talking with Rajiv Vinakota, president of the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, which believes in strengthening democracy through the development of civically engaged and well-informed young people. Rajiv leads the Institute's mission to cultivate the talent, ideas, and networks that develop lifelong, effective citizens. Raj, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Greg, it's great to be here.
So Raj, I love having you here, and I noticed in a post on the Institute for Citizens and Scholars website, published about a year or two ago, you wrote this: Americans are drawing battle lines online, at school board meetings and college campuses, and in the hallowed halls of our nation's capital. In this divided nation, one thing seemingly unites all of us: a grave concern that our democracy is at risk. So Raj, my first question for you is this: how did we get here?
I wish that I could point to a very simple line for how we got here, Greg, but it's taken many decades, and I would say many decisions that we didn't even recognize were leading us down this road. So the core democracy issue here, at least in my mind, is that we have forgotten how to develop citizens for a self-governing polity. And if you want to think about any of the challenges that we face right now, I believe that's because we don't have the civically well-informed, productively engaged, and committed citizens that this nation needs. How did we get here? There's certainly some policy decisions that were made over time, and I would argue especially and sometimes inadvertently in our K-12 school system. We started to decrease the number of social studies classes that we had, and especially civics courses. In the 1990s and early 2000s, we started to focus heavily on accountability, on tests, and therefore focused on math and reading and writing. And I know this, Greg, because I was part of that movement. But with the emphasis and focus on those areas, that's where the money went, that's where the time went. And then about 15 years ago, we said, we are not ready for the STEM revolution, and that's where all the jobs will be. And so we invested heavily in STEM. With each of these decisions, our focus and time on social studies, civics, history decreased significantly, literally to the point where we are significantly under investing in all of those efforts. We have also decided that we're not focusing on those things outside of school. And so Robert Putnam and Bullying Alone was a seminal book, but it wasn't just talking about adults. It was also talking about how you invest in young people. And not having all of those different ways of engaging in your community then went to the younger population. And so they don't have as many little leagues as they used to have. There aren't as many community institutions. And in fact, because it's just much harder to make ends meet, parents, families aren't as engaged in developing their young ones, not just from an education perspective, but also how they engage in their communities. So for all of these reasons, our emphasis and even our thinking around citizen development has really cratered.
Raj, you point out something that on one hand is so obvious and yet is so unclear, and that is we practice becoming citizens. We practice how to learn. We practice how to speak. We practice how to arrange numbers in mathematic formulations. So why don't we practice what it means to become a citizen? You argue and advance the idea that one of the things we need to do in this country, as you were just alluding to, is develop effective citizens. So can you tell us more about that phrase, effective citizen, and what an effective citizenry might look like?
When you want to start with this notion of what does it mean to be an effective citizen, we really look at it around three categories. The first is we say that you need to be civically well-informed. So do you understand how your government functions? Do you understand the historical underpinnings of how we got here? Do you get your information from multiple and diverse sources? And finally, Do you have the skills to be able to discern and differentiate between facts, opinions, misinformation, disinformation? So that's the first category, being civically well-informed. The second category is to be productively engaged for the common good. So obviously that means, do you vote? But it also means, how do you engage in your community? Do you volunteer? Do you mentor? Do you run for office, and so on? And the third part of that category is, do you have the skills to engage in thoughtful civil discourse, even with people with whom you don't agree? And then the third and final category is, are you committed to democracy in America? And that has notions of trust. Do you trust your government? Do you trust your institutions? Do you trust your neighbor, even if that neighbor didn't necessarily vote like you did? And then are you committed and hopeful about the direction of our country? So this is a much broader definition of what it means to be a citizen, right? There's a tendency sometimes to over-index on, do you understand the Constitution? Or are we making sure that you're voting? But you take this broader notion and you start to realize, yes, schools have to do their work, but you also have to do this work in your communities. You also have to do this work online and even in your first job. And so you have to be able to role model what it means to be able to engage in thoughtful civil discourse. You have to role model voting. You have to show a commitment to your fellow man, to your neighbor in very different ways, in addition to knowing the specifics of how your government and your nation works. That all does take practice.
And as you've noted, one of the places where we begin to practice what it means to become an effective citizen is at school. I have an eighth grader. She is in a civics course right now. Most students in this country still have some form of civics education, even if it isn't the robust social studies and history and civics coursework for which you and I might hope. So tell us, where is civics education still succeeding in this country, and where and how is it falling short?
Well, we're a long way from civics education succeeding in this country, Greg. We do have courses, and the good news is that over the last decade, there's been a recognition that we need to do more and to reinstate having civics requirement, both at the middle school and in the high school, so that there are new standards that have come in. Not surprisingly, those interventions or attempts have looked very different in different places. Certain states, for example, require you to take the naturalization exam and demonstrate that you can pass it. Others are much more input driven. You need to take 2.5 semesters of courses that focus around government and history and so on. I would say probably the most exciting movement and work that's happening is a consortium called the Educating for American Democracy Project. It started about 5 years ago, really developed a series of questions and historical understandings that we needed to teach. And they're more open-ended, and they require you not to just have rote learning, right? But rather understanding the arc of our nation and understanding where we are, what are the expectations and responsibilities of being a citizen and so on? What is your role? Who are great role models? So there is movement. There is a clear understanding. There are things that are happening at the local and in different states. We just need that to accelerate.
So you've just identified a bright spot, Educating for American Democracy, the Educating for American Democracy Project. So if I'm listening to this pod, I'm driving in my car, I'm walking around my neighborhood, tell me, where can I go find information about this project?
You can look it up online, the Educating for American Democracy Framework. It has a great starting point. It talks about the things that should be taught, and they're largely in open-ended questions and inquiry. You can take all that information. There are also a whole set of institutions led by my friends over at iCivics and Democracy Knowledge Project who are building out programming around that. But it can serve as a scaffolding. And in fact, there's a lot that you can even just do at home with your children.
Raj, at the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, you do so many things, one of which is investing significantly in fellowships, in people, researchers and advocates who are as young as 14 to early stage academics to top level state and university officials. Can you tell us more how and why you invest so much in people in this way?
Sure. So we actually have a long history here at the Institute for Citizens and Scholars. We were founded in 1945. At that time, we were known as the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. And a number of deans of faculty across the country realized that we did not have enough professors to be able to teach all of the returning GIs. And so they came up with the idea of actually recruiting returning GIs with advanced degrees and convincing them to go into academia instead of the family business or corporate America. That was 1948. 1958, the Ford Foundation came and said, we really like the work that you're doing. You should expand the pipeline even further, and gave a significant amount of funding over the next 15 years so that this institution was literally selecting thousands of young people into fellowships to go into the professoriate. 1972, when that project came to an end, we decided to start focusing on getting more women and more minorities to come into the professoriate. And so we've been focused largely around higher education. However, we continue to keep focused around the notions of building talent into higher education. But with our two most well-known new programs, the Civic Spring Fellowships, we've said, let's go support young people directly who are doing civic engagement in their communities and support them not only with some funding, but also with communities of practice. And as we announced last year publicly, our College Presidents for Civic Preparedness, which supports college presidents in this work in higher education. In the end, we need to develop the talent to support them, to provide the air cover and their development so that they can be the leaders that our country needs. It's been a demonstrated outcome over now the 75-year history of our organization, and we continue to believe in it deeply.
And as you invest in these people, I know your aspiration is for them to be even more civically well-informed, to be productively engaged, and to be hopeful about democracy, as you say at the Institute for Citizens and Scholars. So tell us more about an institute-supported initiative that makes you more hopeful about democracy and how that's spreading hope to others across this country.
I shared with you earlier our college president's work. Let me give you a little more detail around this. After we decided to go in this direction as an organization, I started calling college presidents. This was in early 2021, and said, what do you do for civic preparation on your campuses? And I chose on purpose a very diverse, broad set of institutional leaders. And they kept telling me what they were doing, but they also kept telling me the two greatest challenges that they were facing in higher education. The first was that higher education's pendulum had swung too far to being viewed as a private good. And we needed to bring it back into balance, that colleges and universities also had a public good set of responsibility to develop its students into the citizens we need and to be bulwarks of democracy. But the second thing they kept telling us was that when they wanted to take bold steps in this area, that the pushback from stakeholders, from students, faculty, administrators, boards, donors, alumni, parents, policymakers, made it nearly impossible to sustain that work. So we said, would there be value in creating a coalition of the willing and creating collective power and air cover around this work? So we started engaging on this a few years ago. And last year, August 15th, we came out publicly with College Presidents for Civic Preparedness with 15 institution leaders who decided to focus around three major areas. The first, which we called Campus Call for Free Expression, was about reclaiming the narrative and the work around free expression and critical thinking on our campuses. And they wanted to take presidential priorities on ensuring that the notions of free inquiry and open thinking were basically pervading throughout the campus culture. The second is they asked us to help build a faculty institute to support faculty who wanted to bring contentious issues in the classroom, but sought the skills and the tools and the practice to do it right. And then the third thing they asked and that we worked on with them was to create a set of measures to try to identify how we could know whether or not we were making progress around civic preparation. So that project, which started last August 15th with 15 presidents, has blossomed, grown, expanded. You can use whatever word you want. As of today, we're at 102 college presidents from a very broad set of institutions. Over the last 2 months, we also started accepting two-year college presidents who joined this work, all of whom believe at its core that higher education has a critical role in developing students for our democracy and believe that that should be an affirmative and priority work on their campuses. And you're seeing all kinds of things happening around there. It's really exciting.
It's so exciting, Raj. Can you just name some of those campuses? There's so much consternation across this country about what's happening on our college campuses, what isn't happening on our college campuses. And this is exciting work. This is common ground work that we ought to be celebrating in higher education across America. Where are some of the places that this is happening?
We've got, of course, most importantly, the University of Pittsburgh. Also, Benedict College, Claremont McKenna College, Cornell, Dartmouth, Denison, James Madison University, DePauw, Skidmore, University of Denver, University of Tulsa, Wellesley, Notre Dame, Georgetown, Montclair State, Howard, Rutgers. The list goes on and on. But it's, as you can tell, even from that small subset, it's public and privates, it's flagship state universities, regional state university, community colleges, historically Black institutions. You get schools that are very progressive to schools that are conservative. It's a real great way both of demonstrating the diversity of higher education, but also bringing all of them together in a shared enterprise is incredibly energizing.
This is Greg Baer. I'm talking with Rajiv Vinakota, president of the Institute for Citizens and Scholars. Raj, you've long been a leader. In 1998, you helped to found the Seed School in Washington, D.C., which is the nation's first urban public boarding school. So if you'll allow, I want to take a left, maybe a right-hand turn here. Tell us a little bit about that school, the Seed Foundation, and the network of college preparatory boarding schools that you still support today.
Sure. Let's go back down memory lane, right, Greg? In 1998, my business partner, Eric Adler, and I founded the Seed School in Washington, D.C., the nation's first urban public boarding school. We literally chose our incoming class of seventh graders through a lottery, picking 40 ping pong balls out of a machine so that 20 boys and 20 girls could come and live with us 5 days a week, Sunday night through Friday afternoon, so that we could ensure that they could get the type of education supports so that they could be just amazing students. We grew that school from those 40 students to 350 grades 6 through 12 students, all coming from Washington, D.C., graduated that first class, and every single one of our students was accepted to four-year institutions. And we graduate, roughly speaking, about 50 to 60% of our students from those four-year institutions as well. There was so much demand that we started similar schools in Baltimore and Miami during my 18-year tenure, and we just opened a fourth school in LA a few years ago. And Greg, the driving force here was a simple one, that if we provided the kinds of support and, frankly, both the access and constant connection with role models and making sure that they didn't run into all of the challenges that many of them did in their communities, that we could ensure that they would do just as well as, quote unquote, any other child. And we were able to demonstrate that. And we also got a chance to see society actually investing in our children in a way that we often talk about, but don't always do. And, you know, the stories and the connections that I built, and now our oldest students are themselves parents, are themselves sending their children to schools, employed, doing great things in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. It's a joy to be able to connect with them.
And Raj, for you, what's the through line that links your work with the Seed Foundation to your work today helping to develop effective citizens at the Institute for Citizens and Scholars?
Okay, you understand just as well as I do that looking back, things look very linear. At its core, I'm motivated by wanting to take on challenges that require, frankly, societal investment of very deep and long ways, and being able to ensure that we pass along to next generations what they need to be in a thriving, flourishing civil society. Part of my life was spent around educating students in middle school and in high school, and then also recognizing that pure academic education wasn't enough, that what we're actually trying to do is develop the sort of young people and adults who will be able to take all that we've done and continue on the trajectory of progressing our nation, making our nation more perfect every single day, and recognizing over the last 10 years that because of decades worth of lack of focus or lack of investment, that we need to do a better job of making sure that we're ready for self-government.
Raj, you're a remarkable person who's done remarkable things. And so we've come to the point in the pod that we want to know a little bit more about you. So we're going to play a bit of a lightning round of questions here. First answers that come to mind, are you ready to play?
Let's go.
First, as the son of a university professor and a second grade teacher, it's clear that education has probably always been important to you. So can you tell us about one teacher who made a lifelong impact on you?
My eighth grade English teacher, Miss Kohler, was probably the most challenging teacher I ever had. And she really, really pushed me. But one of the things I appreciated is outside of that tough exterior, she really, really cared. And you always knew that. I learned more in that class than any other class in middle school and probably in most of high school.
Raj, you studied molecular biology along with public policy, to be sure, in your undergraduate years. So what's a lesson from biology that you carry with you in your work today?
Oh, I think about what I learned in biology and science and frankly apply it every week because at its core, molecular biology and science is about developing hypotheses and testing them. And that's what I've been doing is I've had different hypotheses for how we think we should tackle these major challenges. We apply them, we rigorously measure them, try to understand whether or not things are working, and continually tweak it. So for me, the scientific method has been part of my DNA, no pun intended, since I've been involved in all of my work in nonprofits.
And Raj, you've been identified and celebrated by so many people across this country as an effective social entrepreneur. So what advice do you have for aspiring social entrepreneurs, especially in the education space?
I think by far the most important thing that social entrepreneurs have to be able to take into account is that they might be wrong. You have to bring humility and stubbornness and equal value to your work. And I find very few social entrepreneurs who are lacking in stubbornness. They need to also have the humility to question whether or not the information that they're getting is telling them to continue in this direction or to tweak what they are developing. The best entrepreneurs, best social entrepreneurs, are the ones who can continually see what they're doing, learn from what they're doing, and tweak it to make it better.
And before we go, just one more question, Raj. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
I think the most important thing that we need to remember in education is that young people are always looking at us. So we need to role model the things that we want them to be doing all the time.
Many thanks to Rajiv Vinakota, president of the Institute for Citizens and Scholars. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.